This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. Item one on the program today, Gary who? Item number two, banking and the regulation thereof. Item three, Bear Stearns, a very long 10 years ago today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, March the 14th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The new economic name you need to know today is Kudlow, Larry Kudlow. Announced this morning as the new director of the White House National Economic Council, replacing the soon-to-depart Gary Cohn. If you watch television business news, you might know of Mr. Kudlow or know of him. If perchance you don't, we've got Marketplace's Kimberly Adams on the phone live from our bureau in Washington for a quick introduction. Hey, Kimberly.
Hi, Kai.
So let's, television aside, let's do a little establishing of Mr. Kudlow's bona fides here, shall we? Because he has some.
Yeah, he's had a long political career, both in politics and other parts of government, starting in the Federal Reserve Bank in New York. He was there for a while. He also served in the Office of Management and Budget under the Reagan administration. And then in the private sector, he spent a decade at Bear Stearns, but he was out of there before the crisis hit, of course.
Yeah, of course. And he's, you know, he's got a long string of chief economist jobs all over Wall Street. Talk to me then about what he's going to do for the president and, more importantly, what he has done to date, because he talks a lot on CNBC about, you know, I got off the phone with the president. I was talking to people at the White House. I mean, he knows people there.
Yeah, he's definitely been in touch with the president and advising him informally for a while now, and has actually been kind of tough on the president, especially in recent weeks, on the issue of these tariffs. He said that tariffs are taxes, especially on the middle class. He's dialed that back a bit since the tariffs are now a bit more limited, exempting some of America's allies and some of our top steel and aluminum trading partners. But generally, Kudlow likes free trade. And his other policy positions line up pretty well with the president. He likes tax cuts, fewer regulations, and he thinks the president's been doing a pretty good job.
All right. So what do you think is going to happen now that he is inside the tent rather than out?
So he's probably going to be a counterweight, a free trade counterweight in particular, to the more protectionist voices in the administration, like those of Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and Trade Advisor Peter Navarro. President Trump says that he likes to have a variety of opinions in the room, sometimes duking it out. And so in bringing in Kudlow, he's bringing in someone he knows will challenge him. Also, it helps that Kudlow is very media savvy. But here's an interesting thing. Unlike a lot of the other people in this administration, Kudlow's been in the media for so long, you can pretty much go online and look at his columns or his radio show and his television appearances and see where he stands on a host of economic issues. And that gives something that Wall Street likes, which is a bit of predictability in this White House.
Right. Right. Let me back you up for a second to that thing about Peter Navarro and Wilbur Ross, who are much more hawkish on trade than Larry Kudlow is. And the thing the president said the other day, where he likes to have people fighting it out in front of him. We now are set for more of that, right? It used to be Gary Cohn fighting it out with Peter Navarro, and now it's going to be Larry Kudlow.
Right, but if you listen to Kudlow on TV today in his CNBC gig, he was saying he's already had conversations about how those conflicts are going to be negotiated. And one of the things he said is that, you know, they've all kind of agreed that they'll fight it out in the conversation and in the negotiations. Mm. But once the president makes a decision, they're going to stick with it and move on.
Marketplace's Kimberly Adams live on the line from our bureau in Washington about the newest economic face at the White House, Larry Kudlow. Kimberly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
I was actually down at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today in Lower Manhattan, the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, talking to some people. Traders early this morning seemed in fine fettle, could not keep it up, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The floor debate in the United States Senate today was spent on banking, bank regulation to be specific, SB 2155, often called the Crapo bill after its lead sponsor, Idaho Republican Mike Crapo. It is widely expected to pass with bipartisan support, and there's a whole lot of changes in the thing, including rolling back some of the Dodd-Frank regulations put on big banks after the financial crisis. But as Marketplace's Ryan Kailath reports, one of the bigger fights is about just what makes a bank big to begin with.
The classic argument for changing the Dodd-Frank rules goes like this. Yes, big banks are systemically important, too big to fail, they need regulation, but Dodd-Frank, critics say, did too much, applying those same restrictions to smaller banks where they're onerous and unnecessary. Rolling it back gives those banks room to do business. On the Senate floor last week, Elizabeth Warren disagreed.
The lobbyists swear up and down. They're fighting for small banks, banks that aren't risky and didn't cause the financial crisis. Give me a break.
Progressives contend all the small bank rhetoric is simply salesmanship. Mirza Baradaran, dean at the University of Georgia Law School, says when we hear community bank, we tend to picture,
you know, these George Bailey underdogs, tiny little banks that are struggling on Main Street, helping the mom and pop grocery store and the first-time homeowner trying to reach the American dream. That's not the industry.
Instead, she says the quote-unquote small banks here are really regional powerhouses making huge loans. They haven't handled mom-and-pop accounts in years. What she really wants is to see regulation tailored to each bank's business model and risk profile rather than an arbitrary size threshold. Rob Nichols of the American Banking Association agrees.
Doesn't make a lot of sense that a bank at $9.9 billion and a bank at $10.1 billion are supervised in a dramatically different way.
Nichols says the current rollback bill isn't perfect, but it keeps the necessary consumer protections in place while helping small banks cope. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
One proposal in the Senate banking bill could bring some changes to the mortgage finance industry. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which backed nearly half of all mortgages issued in this country last year, would have to use alternatives to the FICO score when evaluating somebody's creditworthiness. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank explains what's going on there.
FICO, formerly known as Fair Isaac Corporation, uses information from credit reporting agencies to generate a credit score. It's had a monopoly on mortgages at Fannie and Freddie. Lori Goodman at the Urban Institute says the problem with that is that many potential borrowers don't qualify.
If you don't have a credit card, an auto loan, or you don't have a mortgage, chances are very good that you don't have a FICO score.
VantageScore, owned by Experian, Equifax, and TransUnion, considers alternative sources of credit like rental history and cell phone bills. To get a score, consumers need just 1 month's credit history instead of six with FICO. WalletHub analyst Jill Gonzalez says a change would be good for potential borrowers.
Particularly those with less than 6 months of credit experience or no open credit card or loan accounts. A lot of people fall into that category, about 35 million people.
But Gonzalez says increasing access to credit also has its downsides.
We're already on a slippery slope just with credit in general in America. We just surpassed the $1 trillion credit card debt mark for the first time in our history.
And there are some fears within the industry about the motive behind VantageScore.
What we have here is an industry of monopolies who are fighting with each other.
That's investment banker Christopher Whalen.
The three repositories who control all of your data are basically trying to push FICO out of the way.
Whalen says it may not matter if Congress mandates competition. Lending decisions are still up to lenders. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
The fight for control of your refrigerator heated up today. Walmart said it's going to expand its grocery delivery business to 100 cities, almost half of all American households, by the end of the year. As Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports, it is going to be expensive for Walmart, but something the company probably has to do if it's going to keep up with you-know-who.
If Amazon is doing it, then we should do it. That's a big part of the thinking behind Walmart's latest move, says Paula Rosenblum of RSR Research.
I think that there's a sense that this is the last frontier of home delivery. You know, the old saying, be there or be square.
And lots of competitors are already there. Amazon has been rolling out same-day delivery from Whole Foods in a growing number of cities. Kroger, Costco, Target, they're also in the mix.
The holy grail for all retailers is going to be able to deliver whatever product they're selling to the consumer within an hour.
Ken Perkins is president of Retail Metrics. He says online grocery delivery is still a tiny business. It makes up less than 5% of the almost $900 billion grocery market. And shoppers who buy their food online tend to be more affluent, a potential new customer for Walmart.
Ultimately, they'd like to go upscale a bit more and garner more of that upper middle-income consumer.
Grocery delivery could help boost growth in Walmart's online business, which hit a big speed bump last quarter. But it's a costly model, says Ananda Chakravarti, a retail analyst with Forrester.
You have a lot of logistics pieces that need to be taken care of. There's a backlash potential when customers are being provided substitute products that are not available in the store that they may or may not like.
And it takes a lot of workers. Walmart already has 18,000 personal shoppers, and it's adding thousands more. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
There was a moment back in 2013, 2014, when a company named Theranos was everything a tech startup was supposed to be, a cutting-edge $9 billion company with a charismatic young founder, a woman no less, that was going to revolutionize the $50 billion-a-year blood testing industry. But that technology turned out to be a fiction. It had to correct or retract thousands of inaccurate blood tests. And today, the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, charged that founder, Elizabeth Holmes, with a, quote, elaborate years-long fraud. Holmes has settled with the SEC. She didn't admit any wrongdoing, but this one is a biggie. So we got Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech, on the phone live to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So remind me, would you, what the technology breakthrough that Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, in theory, had that was supposed to be such a big deal? What was it?
Yeah, the breakthrough was that Theranos' technology would be able to run dozens of blood tests, maybe up to hundreds of blood tests, on a single drop of blood so that it would dramatically reduce the amount of blood needed per draw. And it would also be really cheap, maybe about $10 for a single test compared to the normal $175 or so. It claimed the test would be more accurate, and it rolled out these wellness centers in stores. So you'd be able to walk into Walgreens or Safeway, both of which set up these whole, you know, reconfigured their stores around this and get your one drop of blood drawn and have the tests in minutes. It turned out, of course, though, that by the time it rolled out into stores, it didn't work.
Right. So riddle me this. How did this company get like $700 million in startup funding, valuations at $9 billion? Elizabeth Holmes was on the cover of every tech and, you know, hot new startup magazine out there. How did this happen?
Yeah. And even I think Forbes and Time.
Yeah.
You know, this is one of the issues that comes along with being sort of a tech company, right? A lot of startups are essentially built on a wing and a prayer, a great backstory, a great founder, and a really good PowerPoint. And so what happened is this is a company that charmed venture capitalists and said, you know, look, this is a proprietary technology. It's super secretive, and it has to be because this is the entire foundation of our company that's going to change everything. And so normally, if there were scientific or medical claims, that would have to be peer reviewed. There would have to be published papers.
Right.
But, you know, investors didn't do that due diligence. They'd either get shut out of the board of directors, or they'd get on the board and kind of believe them. And as the funding stages got later along, then you'd have these investors saying, well, look, Draper Fisher Jurvetson is here. Oracle founder Larry Ellison is an investor.
The biggies, yeah.
They've gotten this far. The tech must be real.
We have to say, though, that this company was aggressive in putting down investigations and journalistic enterprises that looked into claims that a technology was not working. I mean, they went to the wall on this one.
Yes, absolutely. And that was what was so notable is you did have medical professionals. You did have investors starting to ask questions. You know, of course, the Wall Street Journal was the one who essentially blew this story wide open in 2015. There were questions before then, but the company was always, like you said, very aggressive about saying the whole point of this is that it has to be a secret. So they actually rejected some of that peer review, and that should have been a red flag to investors and board members.
So in 30 seconds, where do we go from here? Because biotechnology is extremely hot. It's extremely lucrative. And there are companies out there who want to do what Theranos did, except on the up and up.
Yeah. And I think that's the question that venture capitalists have to be asking is what is the structure? What's the system for oversight and for verifying claims that these companies make?
Molly Wood, the host of Marketplace Tech. Molly, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
Coming up,
it was utter confusion. It took everybody in the office by surprise.
Financial crises happen really, really slowly and then all at once. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 248 points today, about 1%, ended at 24,758. The NASDAQ down about 14 points, a 10%, 74.96. S&P 500 down 15.5%, 27.49 there. Retailers reeled as the Commerce Department announced a dip in last month's retail sales figures. JCPenney rolled down 7%. Kohl's burned off 2.9%. Macy's slammed down 0.7%. Today, banks fell in line with declining bond yields, more about which in a second. Citigroup rushed down 1.9%. Today, JPMorgan Chase off 1.1%. Aerospace giant Boeing gave back 2.4% today on fears the company could lose orders from China if the U.S. imposes tariffs on Chinese export, as has been bandied about of late. Boeing's biggest supplier, Spirit AeroSystems, tumbled 5.2%. About those bond yields, prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note actually fell to 2.81%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
And we are back with our podcast, Make Me Smart, asking people the question that never fails to get a great answer.
I would say...
eventually.
What is something that you thought you knew and then later found out you were wrong about? Take a moment, take a breath, think about it.
It's going to take a while.
Tell us your answers.
Check us out, makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 10 years ago today, an 85-year-old investment bank named Bear Stearns became the very public face of the financial crisis in this economy. Only a $29 billion loan guarantee from the Federal Reserve and J.P. Morgan stepping up with a buyout kept Bear from actual bankruptcy. The company, though, was ruined. The first real domino to fall as the crisis unfolded that summer of 2008. Our project about the crisis and how the 10 years since have changed this country is called Divided Decade, and we are marking the collapse of Bear Stearns a decade ago today by looking at the financial infrastructure that made the crisis so contagious and whether things might be different now. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the story.
Bear Stearns was a Wall Street titan, and when it started to look like it was failing under the weight of bad bets on mortgages, people started to panic.
Bear Stearns today leading the tumble on Wall Street, the stock plunging 45%.
That panic spread fast.
Bear Stearns shares are down 90% this morning, and it's not just Bear. Pretty much every single bank is plunging in early trade this morning.
The Federal Reserve and J.P. Morgan stepped in and bailed out Bear.
After Bear was resolved, I think there was a sense of relief for a little bit.
Michael Feroli is chief economist at J.P. Morgan and was working for the bank at the time. A few months later, Lehman Brothers failed. Then insurer AIG collapsed.
Everyone was, I think, looking around and saying, all right, you know, we've had a sequence of failures. Who's the next?
There have been a lot of bubbles and a lot of bad bets in financial history. But what set this financial crisis apart was its contagiousness. The bad bet underneath it all, the bad mortgages, the financial system has survived worse.
The size of the losses in the internet bubble in 2000 and 2001 were actually bigger than the size of the losses in the housing market in the Great Recession.
Chris Mayer is professor of real estate at Columbia Business School.
But a bunch of people who had had paper profits and lost money in the internet bubble didn't destabilize the financial system.
The difference was that small losses were magnified through such a system
of layers and layers of debt.
Annette Admati teaches at Stanford School of Business. Banks borrowed to make bad bets and then didn't have a lot of money in reserve. So when they lost their bets, they didn't have much of a cushion.
It was a very, very interconnected, intertwined web of commitments, like a house of cards.
And of course, to make matters worse, they were all making the same bad bet on mortgages that had been repackaged so often that nobody quite knew if they were even exposed or not. One question often asked today is whether there are other assets out there that are as deeply interwoven within the system and as poorly understood.
You will often see people allege things like car loans are the new subprime housing or student loans are the new subprime housing.
Austin Goolsbee teaches economics at Chicago's Booth School. He chaired the Council of Economic Advisors under Obama.
They may be things that there are a lot of defaults on, but that's different from this is a thing that's going to bring down the financial system and spread from institution to institution.
Banks haven't piled layer upon layer of bet after bet on car loans and student loans, and these assets and markets are pretty well understood.
The banks themselves have tried to reduce the amount of debt and leverage they have. There are a variety of ways they've tried to limit the amount of fire spreading.
Of course, in 2010, President Obama signed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, a sprawling law that, among many other things, required banks to hold more capital to cushion against losses.
I think the law we passed will prevent the problems that caused the last crisis from recurring.
Congressman Barney Frank, now retired, was the Frank in Dodd-Frank. He was one of the sponsors.
But you don't know what the new problems are. You know, one of the problems is the financial system innovates and regulations don't always catch up.
Frank worries the current administration isn't putting enough resources to regulators.
What worries me is our ability to find the next problem. They've diminished that capacity.
Stanford's Anat Admati is a lot more pessimistic than that.
They've changed very little, unfortunately. The system is still incredibly fragile.
But one big defense against another financial crisis may be the fact that we're still talking about the last one. Kenneth Rogoff is professor of economics and public policy at Harvard.
If you really ask the big picture on why we're less vulnerable today, some of it has to do with regulation, but a lot of it has to do with that people are just still so on edge, even 10 years after the financial crisis. They're so chastened by that experience.
There is something to be said for the old expression, once burned, twice shy. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The thing about Bear Stearns was that it was the first one to go, so everybody involved remembers where they were when it happened. That includes a guy named Ben Bernanke.
With Bear Stearns, I very well remember the conversation. I was on my cell phone getting out to the car in the morning, and Tim and Hank were on the phone, and we were saying, well, here's how we could do it. Should we do it or not? What are the pros? What are the cons? And we decided, okay, it's a go. We're going to do it. So we agreed to do it. We never had that conversation with Lehman because we never had a viable option.
Former Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, my conversation with him and former Treasury Secretaries Hank Paulson and Timothy Geithner, the four of us sitting around a couple of microphones talking for an hour or so, coming up on Monday. Financial crisis was of Wall Street, of course, but it wasn't just about the big financial institutions. There were millions of people in this country caught up in the near collapse of the American economy, some of them actually working on Wall Street. Vinay Kapoor was working at Bear Stearns when everything began to crumble there, and it only got worse for him.
So in 2008, my son was born on March 13 at around 6:45 p.m. The reason I know the time very well is because it was funny, because as soon as my baby was born, my phone started to ring, and I hadn't shared the news with anybody. When I started replying back, it was around 8 o'clock. People were not congratulating me. They were asking me if I'm okay and if everything is fine, and they asked me to turn the TV on because that was the time when Bear Stearns had declared bankruptcy, and it was all over the news. It was utter confusion. It took everybody in the office by surprise. I had to cancel my leave of absence, and I actually went back to work the next Monday. I was more concerned about healthcare coverage because I had just had a baby, and that was the time I needed it the most. And the other thing was I was on an H-1B at the time. So I didn't even know how that is going to get played out because it was a very unique situation at the time. So what happened after that was I picked up a position at Lehman Brothers. So I essentially went through the entire same cycle 5 months later. That hit us very hard. It was a lot of added stress at home. It affected my wife exactly as much as it affected me. We firmly believe in a lot of frugality now. We are not shy of talking money to our son. For example, if we would go and buy him a toy car, we would ask him, if he can find the same car for a cheaper price at another location, I'll buy him two of those. We basically try to explain him the value of money and the value of saving, and that frugality is something that is part of your personality. It is not really something that you can learn over time, and it becomes more and more difficult if you don't follow it earlier on. My wife is pretty much sure that it will happen again in his lifetime for sure.
We've got pictures of Vinay Kapoor on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, tell us how the crisis changed you, would you? The hashtag we're using is How We Changed. This final note on the way out today, the chaser to the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos fraud shot earlier in the program. Remember the big Equifax data breach last year? Private information for 143 million people in the care of the credit reporting agency set loose into the wild. Well, today, federal prosecutors charged an executive at Equifax with insider trading using inside knowledge of the breach and that it had happened before the public found out to sell his shares in the company and profit thereby. All right, we are out of here. The Dow Industrial's off 248 points today, about 1%. NASDAQ down 14 points. That's a 10%. S&P 500 lost 15 points, a half percent there. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody, back in Los Angeles. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.